You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. Thanks for joining us for a second episode of Talk It Out. This week, I speak to Dr. Patrick Egan, a political science professor at New York University. Patrick is an expert on public opinion and polling, and offers his insights on what we can learn from election polls, but also describes difficulties pollsters have encountered in those years when Donald Trump has been on the ballot. I also speak to Victoria Kirby York, Director of Public Policy at the National Black Justice Coalition, which advocates on behalf of Black LGBTQ people. Victoria discusses the broad range of challenges and concerns felt by her community as the election approaches, and the effort she believes is required to mobilize Black LGBTQ and Black voters generally this coming November. My guest is Dr. Patrick Egan, a professor in New York University's Political Science Department and with NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. Patrick studies and writes about American public opinion and the influence it has on policy, partisanship, and identity. And he's here today to talk about opinion polling and also about a concept called issue ownership. Thank you for joining the podcast, Patrick.
Great to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me.
In the last several election cycles, dating back at least as far as 2016, a lot of people I know burned up tons of time and energy checking and rechecking and refreshing their browser to see what the polls were saying. Can you offer general advice on how anxious voters should consume and think about polls?
Well, I don't have good therapeutic advice for the anxiety. I understand why people would feel that way. In terms of polls, you know, we're a little bit in a no man's land right now in terms of election polling, which, as you and probably many of your listeners know, the election polls for the last two presidential elections have been really far off. And that included even the high quality election polls. Typically, when we think about high quality polls, we like surveys that are done with representative samples and done in a way that potential voter has an equal probability of being surveyed. As it's become harder and harder to reach people by like telephone, for example, a lot of firms, including very good firms, have used different techniques to reach people, including internet opt-in panels, et cetera. And we are really at a point right now where I think we're a little bit unclear about which of these techniques is best at reaching voters, just because, again, the best surveys in 2016 and 2020 really missed the mark in terms of over-predicting votes for Clinton in 2016 and Biden in 2020. So I don't have great advice for you and your listeners on that. The one thing to kind of always look at is to never put any stock in one particular poll, particularly a poll that you like the result. We all want to do that, of course. And sure, Instead to look at these aggregators like at 538 or Real Clear Politics, where they're kind of looking at trends. And if you see trends moving in one direction or another, that's usually meaningful in that that tells you that all of the numbers, regardless of how they're collected, are moving in concert. And that's where I would say that's the one place where I would start to feel a little bit comfortable that you're really picking up something meaningful with the polls.
Should voters be concerned, particularly Democratic voters, be concerned that the errors in recent polls have tended to underestimate both Trump voters and Republican voters generally in down ballot races?
Absolutely. I mean, everyone should be concerned, right? Because polling is something that's, I think, vital to democracy. It helps us understand what's happening and what just happened when we have an election. And we are in this circumstance right now where the problem has really been largely limited to presidential election polls where Trump has been on the ballot. It's really quite remarkable. So if you think about the elections between or since those two presidential elections we were just talking about, the 2018 midterms and the 2022 midterms, the high quality polling was actually pretty on the mark. And those were polls where Democrats saw good numbers for their candidates and said, oh no, these are going to be off because polls tend to overestimate Democratic support. And sure enough, those were totally fine. So our best guess is that there's something going on when Trump is on the ballot. And we're not sure if it's that these polls failed to reach Trump voters in the first place, or if Trump voters are reluctant to continue a poll once they've realized that it is an election poll. What we don't think is happening is that Trump voters are shy about telling you their preferences once asked. That doesn't seem to be the case. So again, the best minds in polling, both in academia and in the business, I think are still a little bit at sea in terms of figuring out what that means for 2024 and a Biden-Trump rematch.
So you mentioned that Trump voters are not shy about voicing their support for Trump once they get involved in the poll. That's to say there's no embarrassment factor or I'm not supposed to say it, I'm for Trump factor. But you also said that perhaps, and you had sent me a study of the polling done in 2016 that suggested that the anti-institution bias of some Trump voters, that is, they don't believe in our institutions anymore. And one of those institutions is polling, and they therefore just may not participate. Is that what you're alluding to there?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, Trump and other similar candidates around the world in rich democracies have really put their finger on the pulse of a deep skepticism about institutions, whether that be government, education, science, media, et cetera. And one of those institutions, as you just said, is polling. And so I think the kind of person who is sort of an intersection of things, the kind of person who's likely to vote for Trump is unlikely to show up in other kinds of elections. And so, for example, that's one of the reasons the Democrats have done pretty well in midterm elections is that these folks do not show up for midterm elections typically.
Right.
And also, they don't want to talk to the media, and they certainly don't want to talk to anyone they see as representative of the media or of higher ed. And so that's polling, right? And so that is one of the reasons why our sense is these are folks who are reluctant to answer the phone. You know, of course, everybody's reluctant to answer the phone these days, but sure, particularly these people. And then once they realize that they have been contacted for a poll, they're much more likely to discontinue the call.
Gotcha. And you mentioned 538 and you mentioned Real Clear Politics. Do both of those aggregators of polls, do they eliminate what we might think of as low quality polls in their averaging?
538 makes a real effort to do that. Real Clear Politics, much less so. They're kind of a real flat kind of average. The thing is that both of them are in the past two presidential elections have been equally good, and perhaps even Real Clear Politics has been better because, as it turned out, some of these lower, quote unquote, lower quality polls were, whatever they were doing, ended up with numbers that were closer to Trump's ultimate, you know, bigger number than the better quality polls were predicting. So it'll be interesting to see what 538 does this round. You know, what they do is they assign a grade to each pollster based upon their accuracy in the past. And so we'll see if that ends up being the case this time around and how they do that. But again, that's why for me, I don't look so much at the levels of where these polls are, you know, the actual numbers, but I look for change, because change in those numbers means that holding everything else constant, all of the errors and all of the problems, you are seeing real movement in one direction or another. And that, I think, is meaningful.
So a sensible voter then might go back and forth between 538 and Real Clear Politics and make their own judgments as to what it is they're reading and what it is they're being told.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I guess I'll go back to the armchair psychologist. You know, I think as valuable as election polls are, we focus too much of our attention on them in an election race. Look, this is the thing. We know that this is going to be a close race. You know, we have this kind of very strange circumstance where we have a matchup of two, a current incumbent and a previous holder of the office, which hasn't happened in quite a while. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. There's obviously a lot of anxiety. And I wouldn't put, regardless of what side you're on, I wouldn't put too much of my emotional health on the line in terms of looking at these polls. There's still going to be a lot of uncertainty, my guess is, even on election day, in terms of what's going to happen.
Are there inflection points in a campaign where you typically ought to be paying more attention to the polls?
Absolutely, yes. So certainly after Labor Day, all of the previous experience with polls and ultimate election results tells us that it really isn't until the campaign kicks into gear that the polls start becoming accurate measures of what's going to happen on election day. And so, you know, with each additional passing month, that the closer that we get to election day, we put more stock in the polls. Polls are decent, but not great predictors of the ultimate outcome. And of course, if the polls are close, which, you know, at this point, I think most polls would have Trump ahead about 4 points in the national vote and between 2 and 8 points in the swing states. Close polls, just by their nature, end up being less predictive of the ultimate outcome because they're close. So, you know, we'll kind of have to see what happens over the next few months and certainly after Labor Day.
I want to spend a couple of minutes focusing on an issue that you've written about. You've written a book about issue ownership. Can you explain that concept?
Sure. Yeah. So issue ownership is kind of a political science concept that's been around since the 1990s. And it's this idea that in the United States and in a lot of other kind of rich democracies, political parties have brands, and the positive sides of those brands include reputations for caring and handling certain kinds of issues, certain baskets of issues. So in the United States, we would say that the Republican Party owns the issues of taxes and crime and the military, and the Democrats own issues like education, the environment, and healthcare. And what's interesting about this ownership is that these reputations really sustain themselves in remarkable ways, regardless of what the party's leaders try to do. So you and many of your listeners will remember that Bill Clinton tried to take ownership from the Republicans on crime, for example, and had a crime bill, et cetera. And in the book and in polling, I showed that that failed to really put much of a dent in the fact that that voters still say they trust Republicans to handle crime more than Democrats. And the same thing is true for something like Social Security, where George W. Bush tried to take initiative on reforming and privatizing Social Security. And that failed to put a dent in the long-term ownership of that issue among the Democratic Party. And then the other thing is that when we come back to elections, is that when a party's owned issues are salient, when voters are thinking about those issues, that tends to convey a bit of an electoral advantage to the party that owns that set of issues. So if it's an election about healthcare, that helps the Democrats. If it's an election about crime, that helps the Republicans, et cetera.
In terms of trends you're seeing now, there's the abortion issue, of course, that is an issue that the Democrats own. There's the immigration issue, an issue that the Republicans own. Do you see any trends favoring one or the other at this stage?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Abortion is one that in the book, I actually say that neither party owns, in that how you feel about the parties, it really reflects just where you stand on the issue. Whereas something like crime, you might be somebody who loves the Democratic crime bill, right? As a lot of people did in 1996 when Clinton was running for re-election, but still say that you like the Republicans on crime, right? Or you might hate Obamacare, but still say that you trust the Democrats more on healthcare than Republicans, right? And that's the kind of interesting discrepancy you see. What you don't see is a pro-life voter saying that they trust Democrats on abortion or vice versa, right? So that is not to say, Paul, that I think abortion is an issue that's helping Democrats in elections up and down the ballot. Right. And I think it will do so this year. And to be clear, the reason why that's the case is that the Republican Party has staked out a position on abortion, which their platform essentially calls for a national ban on all abortions, zero abortions in the U.S. ever for any reason, right? And that is a position that is much more radical than the typical American wants. I should also say that the Roe position is much more liberal than what the typical American wants. But if you look at how Americans feel about abortion, they're generally somewhere in the place of, like, they would accept a ban at, say, 16 weeks of pregnancy. And that's something like 95% of all abortions carried out in the country right now. So what the Republicans are talking about, and to be more clear, what Republicans don't want to talk about, is the fact that their base really supports a policy on abortion that is much more conservative than what Americans want. And that's why this issue is going to help Democrats in this election.
Patrick, one last question for you. This year's race is unique. First of all, that we have two candidates that are exceptionally well known, probably better known as a pair than any in the past. And they're also both relatively unpopular. Is it possible that this year the focus of the race is going to shift more toward personality than issues? Or is that not a useful way to think about it?
I think it's a very useful way to think about it. And I think you're absolutely right that both candidates are unusually unpopular. I think we've got at least a quarter of the electorate who says they find neither of them favorable when asked about this in election polling. And a lot of those people right now are saying they would vote for some third party candidate. Typically, that number goes down over the course of an election. And so we'll see if that happens. Yes, I would say that both candidates have strong reason to focus on the negatives of the other candidate. Trump's negatives are quite obvious in terms of being somebody who's in all of these trials, has broken all of these norms, continues to say things at rallies that, you know, are just deeply unpopular, as much as they may be appealing to his base. And then, of course, the Republicans in their arsenal have concerns about Biden's age and his cognitive abilities. You can see Biden trying to push back against that at the State of the Universe, et cetera. So, yes, I think both sides will be trying to focus the negatives here. But I should also say that this is an election where there could be a lot of talk about policy, and abortion and immigration are good examples there, where Democrats are really going to try to pin the idea of a national abortion ban on Trump. You see the advertising happening on that already. And Republicans are going to try to run a campaign, which I think is somewhat disingenuous, around Biden not doing enough on immigration. The pushback there is that Biden supported a very conservative immigration bill in Congress, that so did conservatives in Congress, and then they changed their mind the minute that Trump changed his mind on it. So, but my guess is those two issues will be among the mix that we'll be talking about policy-wise in this election.
Patrick, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Yeah, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. My guest is Victoria Kirby York, Director of Public Policy and Programs at the National Black Justice Coalition, a civil rights organization working to empower Black LGBTQ people. Prior to her work at NBJC, Victoria was Deputy Director for Advocacy and Action at the National LGBTQ Task Force, and earlier, the Florida Director of Organizing for Action, which worked to support President Barack Obama's legislative agenda. Welcome, Victoria. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Paul. NBJC is grateful to have the support of Gay City News.
Well, thank you. I'd like to ask you to tell our listeners a little bit more about what the National Black Justice Coalition is and what your group's core efforts involve.
The National Black Justice Coalition has been around for 20 years, and we were founded to build a world free of racism and anti-LGBTQ plus and same gender loving bias, prejudice and discrimination, including against people living with HIV and AIDS. It's been a hallmark of the work that we do, particularly in advocacy spaces and in pushing for civil and human rights laws that include all of us. The work that we do in the election cycle is really about reminding folks to own our votes and own our power, that we have the tools and the information out there and around us to be able to shape our democracy and our nation in the direction that it ought to be and should have been for quite some time. And we are at a tipping point moment, I believe, in our nation's history, where we will either continue to march forward to a multiracial, multicultural democracy and nation, or we're going to move backwards to a monoracial, monoculturally led nation that doesn't embody the spirit of a pluribus unum, out of many one. What that looks like in practice is making sure folks know how to update their voter registration status. That if you moved in many places in this country, you need to file an update to your voter registration, especially if you move to another state, but even if you move across to another side of town in your own county. I mean, if you've never registered to vote, we always want to make sure folks know where they can go to complete that voter registration form, whether it's online or in person. Also to sign up for vote by mail. And you never know which way the wind is going to blow. If you have that vote by mail ballot, though, you still have all of your choices ready for you to be able to make. But also after Election Day, the continued advocacy with lawmakers to push our priorities and push folks to the vision that we aspire our nation to be is just as important, sometimes if not more, but is often less talked about or celebrated.
Yeah, I know that NBJC works day in and day out on policy issues and policy advocacy in Washington and elsewhere around the country. But looking specifically at the November elections, what do you see as the most important stakes for the African-American community and specifically for Black LGBTQ people?
That is a great question. I really believe there's a lot at stake, even in looking at Project 2025 and what the Heritage Foundation has been pushing forward for their vision. Their side is really clear that what they're looking for is a rollback of all of the equity public policies that President Biden has put in place, all of the programs that have really started tackling agency program inequities of all types on the racial side, sex and gender, the LGBTQ plus community. And they talk about it as DEI and being anti-critical race theory and being anti-trans folks playing in sports. But really what it's about is promoting one particular worldview, one that doesn't hold much space for people that look like me or love like me and the people that NBJC fights for every day. When we look at the stakes of this election, it literally comes down to the heart and soul of who we are as individuals and as a nation, and quite literally means whether we're going to continue to have reparation style programs that help to rebuild Black communities that were destroyed by the interstate on purpose, you know, in the 70s and 80s and even earlier, like in my hometown of Tampa, where I-4, much talked about during election season, literally bulldozed through the Black and Brown communities in the county that I grew up in and happened all across this country. President Joe Biden did something about that in the tune of billions. That's something that we don't have to guess whether that's going to happen if there are other candidates that become president, because they've not run or taken the opportunity to make any of those changes. When we look at what he's doing around student loans, there's a big focus in the conversation about people getting something they haven't earned. Well, I'll tell you, I've paid $16,000 towards the $48,000 that I took out. Only $1,000 of that has gone to the principal. $15,000 have gone to interest that was intentionally created to keep folks stuck in continuing to make additional payments. I owe more now today than I took out almost 20 years ago. So that's an issue that's of great importance to Black folks, because many of us, due to Jim Crow policies, due to the legacy of slavery, do not have the generational wealth. Our ancestors were intentionally destroyed or taken over by eminent domain. And so when we talk about our National Equity March that's going to take place Saturday, June 15th, on the National Mall, going from the reflecting pool of the Lincoln Memorial to Black Lives Matter Plaza, when we talk about reparative justice, that's what we're talking about. How we can move public policy that helps to finally address things that have been long-seated wrongs that have continued to plague generation after generation. That, and the continuation of an administration that's thinking thoughtfully about how to address these issues in ways that allow all of us to win as a country, is something that is at stake on the ballot. We are 501c3. We do not endorse candidates. But what I can tell you is some of the other parties who've had candidates who have been president before, when they had opportunities to push for addressing inequities, they decided to ban words like transgender from the CDC, ban terms like looking at racial injustice and climate change. You can look and compare the records of folks who are running in this race to see what is at stake. You can see the fact that when it comes to the Black LGBTQ plus and same gender loving community, that there was a whole fight around renewing PEPFAR, one of the most popular global programs that the United States of America offered that helps to eradicate, seeks to eradicate the HIV virus and epidemic across the globe. And they made it all about abortion, right?
Right.
Which is the right that we should have.
Just to clarify for our listeners, Victoria, you referred to the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, that the Heritage Foundation, the ultra-conservative think tank that has been behind many of recent Republican Supreme Court nominations, has put together a plan anticipating an election of Donald Trump in the fall. And that's the plan that you were referring to in terms of what they're trying to do in terms of moving things backwards.
Yes, it is thicker than the Bible, I would say, almost. And the book systematically goes agency by agency, department by department, with their recommendations and actions to gut addressing and problem solving of systemic inequities on day one.
You've mentioned a lot of very critical stakes there for Americans generally, and specifically for Black Americans, for Black LGBTQ Americans. What do you see as the level of enthusiasm out there right now among Black LGBTQ voters? Is there excitement? Is there, to some degree, a certain weariness with all the political backbiting? Where do you see that right now?
What I see is a lot of fear, because we did live through a Donald Trump presidency, and we see how that impacted folks' lives. And there's a lot of uncertainty that folks feel about what President Joe Biden has done or has not done. But sometimes we get so tunnel visioned into doing the thing that we said we were going to do, we forget to talk to people about the things that we're doing and making sure that people are aware of what's happening. So there's a feeling by folks in the community that the president hasn't tried to follow through or hasn't done the things that he said that he would do, when in fact he's pushed forward nearly 36 executive orders on gun violence prevention. That also includes looking at violence in the inner city and in Black communities, which often before him, we tended to talk mostly about mass shootings and forget about some of the intra-community violence that takes place across this country. You know, the fact that when Congress refused to act on the Voting Rights Advancement Act, named for John Lewis, he pushed out an executive order to try to do as much as the administration could do legally to address some of the voting rights challenges in this country in the voter suppression laws that were being passed. When you look at some of the threats to abortion, some of the threats to LGBTQ rights, he used that Bostock decision on day one to say anywhere that there's sex protections, we're using the Bostock definition of sex that is LGBTQ plus inclusive. So although we're going to keep fighting for the Equality Act, we have protections through the Department of Education and Health and Human Services. We're still pushing some of these agencies, but there are protections that various agencies are moving forward. The Violence Against Women Act includes the trans community, and in particular, Black trans women who are dying at disproportionate rate from violence, that now can seek support through the legislation that President Joe Biden authored decades ago and continues to fight for. So, you know, there's progress, but most people that I talk to about this progress have no idea some of these things have even happened. They don't know that he signed an executive order to create a federal registry for cops who, you know, have abused their power and have taken part in misconduct. So that even though Congress didn't have the votes to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act or the BREATHE Act, there was movement. There was a federal ban on chokeholds. And the push to free, he did free folks who are in jail because of marijuana in federal prisons, and urged other states to do something about it too in their prisons. And some states did. Still more to be done. We want marijuana to be declassified and legalized and decriminalized, all of those things. So it's not perfect, but I think people would be surprised if they actually looked a little deeper at what has happened to know that some of the things that they're going out on TikTok saying the president hasn't done, he's done as much as he legally can.
So it's interesting because I was specifically going to ask you about disappointment about the Voting Rights Act, about the Equality Act, and about student loan forgiveness. And you've hit on all those topics. From your perspective, is this largely a communications problem at this point?
Yes. I think some of it's communication. Some of it is also with our media. They didn't have the same courage that you've had as someone who led Gay City News. There's journalists who get the press releases about what the administration is doing every day, and they make a deliberate choice not to let the American people know about it. They'd rather let the American people know what is going on with Donald Trump and one of the lawsuits he's got going on, which is important, but also not as important as insulin being capped at $35 a month or living with diabetes. Not as important as the fact that there's over $1 billion dedicated to looking into prevention and treatment measures for long COVID, which is just completely debilitating a lot of folks in this country. I do think there's a communications issue, and I think there's enough blame to go around. I think even as advocacy organizations, we can and it should be doing more to talk about some of these programs. It's in part why our policy agenda has an entire section, pillar two, dedicated to talking about the federal public policy programs that resulted from the first 2 years of this administration that looked at the Safer Communities Act and the national suicide hotline number that links kids directly to suicide prevention specialists that are culturally competent for LGBTQ plus young folks and adults, and also Black folks and folks at the intersections, you know, like the folks that we advocate for. We talk about the PACT Act and LGBTQ plus and Black veterans who stand to benefit from so much of the resources for medical care that they need to continue to thrive and for some people survive. And there's so many more programs that we have listed. If you go to nbjc.org, it's one of our sliding carousel images. You can dig into it. It talks about the American Internet Connect program, which helped to make broadband internet access more affordable for folks. Super important for our people in rural communities. There are tons of Black folks in rural communities in the Black Belt in the American South who benefited from that program. But unfortunately, there are some extremists in Congress that don't want to continue to support ensuring that people have access to internet, which allows them to get good jobs, allows them to study in school.
If you look at the 2016-2020 presidential races, the best estimates are that more than 90% of Black voters supported first Hillary Clinton and then in 2020, Joe Biden. And the organizing and turnout among Black women in Georgia in 2020, and then in the two special Senate elections 2 months later in January 2021, has been often cited as critical to the Democratic wins there. At the same time, Victoria, there's been a lot of chatter recently about erosion of support for Joe Biden among particularly Black men. And the Wall Street Journal recently released a poll. It looked at seven swing states, indicating that as many as 30% of Black men could vote for Trump. First of all, do you believe those numbers? Do those seem credible to you?
I don't believe those numbers. And as someone with the Master's of Arts degree in public administration, I think the use of the word could tell us everything we need to know about some of that data. I want to look at the crosstabs of that a little bit more. But what I do know is that in 2016, when Rance Priebus was, or 2014 too, over the RNC, they did invest quite a bit of money in engaging Black men and Black communities and hiring Black male canvassers to get out the vote. And while, yes, they were successful in getting a handful of folks to be supportive of some of their public policies and their candidates, as someone who was in Florida where they piloted some of this stuff, people didn't buy it. People just didn't buy it. And so I think there, where the could comes from, is there are people who might say, hey, I'm open to hearing what, you know, they have to say. There might be some areas of interlap where, you know, I might be more curious. But at the end of the day, do I think 30% of Black men are going to be voting for Donald Trump? the data that I've seen doesn't seem to suggest that. And the Black men in my life don't seem to suggest that either. But I do think it's important that no party takes any group of voters for granted.
Right.
Every single person in this country has to have their vote fought for. Every single person, every single community, and no community is a monolith. There is no singular ideal of who the Black voter is. And that's the same thing for Black men, Black women, Black non-binary folks, folks who are LGBTQ plus and same gender loving and Black. We all have different lived experiences shaped by the peculiarities of what we've lived through and what we've learned and know. And so I think traditionally and historically, at least, you know, since the 60s, progressives have had more of a consistent record in producing public policy solutions and ideas that help to address the issues that Black men and Black people as a whole have had to grapple with, especially around issues of economic opportunity. I don't know what a person who was raised with the silver or gold, platinum, diamond spoon in his mouth can say to people who've had to make sacrifices to make ends meet, who haven't had to truly figure out how the next day's meal was going to make it. I don't know how that's believable, but campaigns are going to do what they're going to do. They're, you know, they sent Donald Trump to Chick-fil-A the other day to try to create this image that he has the support out there. I heard that he said something like, I want the chicken. I mean, well, no, that is what Chick-fil-A does, right?
So you've had a lot of experience in political organizing. In your view, what kinds of efforts are needed to effectively mobilize Black voters and Black LGBTQ voters? What do organizations need to be doing?
I think we have to think about how we think about the persuasion universe much differently. When I came into electoral organizing, we always thought about the persuasion universe of voters as moderate white people, essentially. You know, that's essentially what it was, moderate white people or working class white folks. But we're in an election space that I haven't seen in my lifetime, where you have two people who have served in the office of president running against each other. People know pretty much most of what they need to know about both candidates. And so persuasion isn't going to look the same as trying to educate a voter about who Joe Biden is or who Donald Trump is. A lot of that is already set and baked in the cake. What we have to do is provide a message of hope, and that if we have the right people in office who cares about our priorities, that the grand slam is coming. And when I say the grand slam, I mean like the Serena Williams, like bring it home in a grand slam, kind of a grand slam. But you know, you can't get those wins without having a good serve. And I think that's the question folks are going to really be looking at. Is the serve where it needs to be? Is it worth me coming out to vote? Is it worth me registering to vote? Is what I've seen from any of these candidates enough to make me feel like what I have to contribute matters? And it's our job as advocates, it's also the job of the campaigns too, to make their case. The messages that Black folks really need to hear is the answer to what have you done for me lately? Enough to say, trust me, I've got your back. Like, you've got to make it plain, name it, be specific, bring in personal narratives and stories from people folks trust. You know, there's so many parents who took out loans for their kids who never thought they thought they'd die with their parent plus loans for their children. And when they got that, you know, note that their student loans were paid off, they caught the Holy Ghost, as we would say, the Black church, right? Because it was something we never thought we would see. Those are the kinds of stories that voters need to hear and know about to be able to situate themselves in the wins that we've had. Because it's easy to feel like there haven't been any wins. We've been living through a pandemic. It's been a struggle. We've lost loved ones. We're all still grieving. Many of us are still healing and trying to get our lives back to baseline. And so it's sometimes hard to see through that there have been some changes. it's like the rainbow that's there, but a little too much hidden by the gray clouds that are still out there. And we have to help people find the rainbow. We have to help people get to where they can see what has been made possible and what more is possible, depending on the math. And that it's not just about who's in the Oval Office. It's even more about who's in these state houses, who's governor, who's your state senator and state representative, who's in Congress, because that's the math that matters most. Our executives can't do anything without the numbers to move those policies forward. And the more we can talk about the math, because Black folks are pragmatic voters. You know, we want to know what makes sense. If we can spell it out for folks, that as important as it is to have a good champion in the White House, it's also important to have folks that can serve up, going back to that metaphor, provide the serve for the Grand Slam win.
Well, how are our national organizations, including national LGBTQ organizations, how well are they doing in terms of their outreach and their engagement with the Black community?
Well, we're in a historic moment where, you know, when I formally, you know, became a staff person in this movement 10 years ago, there was not a single Black LGBTQ plus and same gender loving person leading our national organizations. But right now, the National LGBTQ Task Force, the oldest organization in our movement, the Human Rights Campaign, the largest organization in our movement, GLSEN, the organization that's touching our future, right? Our kids and the folks that are teaching them. Family Equality, right? Who's helping to pass laws that support all of our families. That sometimes too often the ways in which Black families show up in our movements have not always been as intentionally included. These organizations are ran by Black people, first time in many of their histories. And that's a pretty big deal. And let me not forget, as a proud member of the L team, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, right? There's so much shifting in our movement in terms of inclusion and thinking about how we ensure that no one in our movement is left behind. We're in the beginning of that. Just having representation isn't the end all to be all. We also have to create systems and good training, good preparation, good programming that is also inclusive of all of our communities and all of who we are. And I see our movement building towards that. And that's even more critical when it comes to our electoral civic engagement work. Because while the gayborhood is a nice place to party, most Black and Brown LGBTQ plus folks don't live in the gayborhood. A lot of our night events are at Black clubs that have a gay night or a ladies night. And so if you're doing a drag the vote, you're doing engagement, you know, for LGBTQ plus folks, and you want to get all of us, you have to hit the gayborhood and you have to hit the Black community clubs that have those nights, and you have to hit the Latin nights. You have to hit all, you have to hit, you know, in the communities that do have really strong AAPI or Indigenous spaces, you have to figure out how to meet our people where they show up. That's the next challenge, is ensuring that our orgs are doing that when we're planning our civic engagement strategies.
So, Victoria, I've mentioned Georgia a couple of times in our conversation. Are you hearing much from folks down in Georgia these days? What's the level of organization going on down there?
I mean, Georgia, they do my heart proud because they've never stopped organizing. Even when the camera stopped, you know, showing on them, they never stopped organizing. And I remember working with the Obama campaign in moments where folks were fighting for Georgia to still be included as a battleground state. And there was a moment where folks said, we don't think we're going to make it. That dropped. I think they came within like 3 percentage points or four. It was 3 or 4 percentage points to winning. And I think that fired those folks up. You know, they're like, y'all got discounted us. The place with one of the fastest growing Black communities in the country. And they've just never stopped organizing. I grew up in Valdosta before moving to Florida. When I heard about the U.S. Senate races, I'll be the first one to tell you, I didn't believe we were going to take either one of them. Reminder, and don't you ever, ever, ever think that Black women can't turn it around, because they did it in Georgia. We can do it in so many of these other Black Belt states. Well, North Carolina for sure has been possible in recent history. Let's make it again. I think there's a lot of promise in the Black Belt South. We just have to get more investments there, and we have to believe and trust in the expertise of folks who know their communities and have never stopped organizing in their communities. They know the influencers, not the ones on TikTok, right? But the ones people really listen to. The mom down the street who's really helped to keep an eye on all the kids in the neighborhood for the last 30 years. The folks who sit at the corner playing dominoes that everybody comes and talks to on their way home. They know who those real influencers are. The folks who will say, if they say to a young person coming home from school, man, you need to make sure you register to vote. You know, this election is serious. Those are the people that are going to be able to shape whether that those young folks show up at the ballot box or fill out that voter registration form or not, or take this whole thing seriously. I think Georgia can do it again. I even have hope for Florida, because I think with some of the mess DeSantis did targeting the Black community, targeting the LGBTQ community, we talk about don't say gay, don't say trans, but they have the whole Stay Sleep Act, right? That's just kind of falling to crumbles right before DeSantis's eyes, where they on purpose don't want folks to know history. And I feel bad for the white kids who are like, I want to know about the children, regardless of their race, who stood firm in the face of adversity, because they want to be the kind of people who stand firm in the face of adversity, regardless of race. You know, wanted to take that entire opportunity away from everybody, not just for Black folks to learn about, Black kids to learn their history, but for us to really fully understand the fullness of American history.
Victoria, I appreciate the time you spent with us. Victoria Kirby York from the National Black Justice Coalition, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Patrick Egan and to Victoria Kirby York for joining me this week. And thanks to all of you for listening. In next week's episode, we begin to look at what's happening on the ground in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania. I'll be speaking to Adam Barbanel-Fried, director of Change the Conversation Together, whose group is already on the ground in Philadelphia, having in-depth conversations with voters in low turnout neighborhoods about the vital stakes in 2024. I'll also speak to Lori Schreiber, a pioneering out lesbian elected official in suburban Montgomery County, the state's third largest county, who is a board member of the National Organization for Women's Pennsylvania chapter. Lori will discuss Montgomery County's importance as the key to the Keystone State. And 2 weeks from now, we'll continue our look at Pennsylvania in a special interview with State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta, a Black gay Philadelphian who is the Democratic candidate for State Auditor General. Look for next week's episode on Wednesday, June 12th, on your favorite podcast platform.